Hi, I'm Tim Hernandez. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Our guest today is the fabulous poet Sun Young Shin, whose latest work, Unbearable Splendor, is out with the legendary Coffeehouse Press. The book is described as, quote, poetry as essay, as a way of hovering over the uncanny, sci-fi, orientalism, Antigone, cyborgs, Borges, and disobedience. Of the collection, Jenny Bowley writes, in Unbearable Splendor, Sun Young Shin sticks a pin directly into the heart of who we are to reveal that a person is a mystery without beginning or end, borders or documents, complicated by robotics and astrophysics, arrivals and departures, myth and rewriting. A person is divided into multiple complicated selves, as various and complex as the forms and approaches she employs in these poetic essays. To read Shin's work is to marvel at a rosebud's concealed and silent core and to slowly witness its elegant blooming. It is a delicate and majestic show. And I would definitely agree that is well and eloquently put about Sun Young's work, and that could be said for all of her books, in fact. I had the good fortune of meeting Sun Young Shin at AWP, the Writers' Conference there. Gosh, I want to say it was in D.C. several years ago with a mutual friend and poet Lee Herrick. And when I first read her previous book, Rough and Savage, I was blown away, and I knew that this was a poet whose work I would be a fan of for years to come. And so I'm really looking forward to this interview with the brilliant poet Sun Young Shin. Stick around. Korean-American poet, writer, and educator Sun Young Shin was born in Seoul, South Korea, and was adopted and raised in Chicago. She earned a BA in English from Macalester College and a master's degree in teaching from the University of St. Thomas. She's the author of Rough and Savage by Coffeehouse Press and Skirt Full of Black, also by Coffeehouse Press, and she received the Asian American Literary Award for Poetry. She's a co-editor of Outsiders Within, writing on transracial adoption, and the author of a bilingual Korean-English illustrated book for children called Cooper's Lesson. It's out with Children's Book Press. Shin has received artist grants and fellowships from Archibald Bush Foundation and twice from the Minnesota State Arts Board. She also recently won the McKnight Fellowship there in Minnesota, and she currently lives and teaches in Minneapolis. Sun Young Shin, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you so much.
Wonderful. Congratulations on this. Is your fourth full-length book?
It's my third full-length book of poetry, but yes. It's actually like my first poetry/essay book.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
It exists in that kind of, you know, gray space between that defies definitions and labels, right?
Right.
It's great, great. And the book that we're talking about here is Unbearable Splendor. It's the new title out with Coffeehouse Press, which is a very reputable publisher that I know have been fans of your work, and they've been supporting you, your last at least couple of publications. Is that right?
That's right. They're very good about taking someone at the beginning of their career and really supporting them if it's a good relationship. So I feel really lucky.
Yeah, that's what I hear. That's what I hear. And I remember when I first picked up your previous book, Rough and Savage, which blew me away. You know, I remember that being published by Coffeehouse and thinking, gosh, you know, this to me is like, you know, an ideal publication for this publisher, you know, because I'm familiar with all the Coffeehouse titles. I think you can't help but be like, as you're an upcoming writer in the world, you can't help but be influenced in some way by Coffeehouse books, right?
Yeah, I think that they, you know, they're not afraid of things that are weird.
Mm.
But I think they also want to do things that feel relevant to, you know, our cultural moment and also problems that poets are trying to solve or right. that writers are trying to solve and be engaged in.
Not only are they not afraid to publish what is, you know, might be weird, but they're also not afraid to publish what is intelligent, you know, intelligent. And also, like you say, what is also going after some of the, you know, even taboo themes and sort of things like that are happening in the world today. And I know that they're always kind of willing to take risks, which is hard to find, I think, in publishers these days, right?
I think so, too. And I also feel like with poetry, not that you asked me, but I think that there's sort of a pressure to have like a high concept book or one book that have a book that has kind of smooth edges
right.
in some ways or can right. be packaged kind of coherently. And I think they want that, of course, but I think they're also okay with just the mess of art in a way. Yeah.
This is kind of maybe an insider question really, but I'm always curious to know because I know a lot of publishers, at least in my experience these days, they expect on their desk is a kind of, you know, a polished, ready to go, already packaged sort of a book or manuscript, you know, but there's something to be said, I think, for when publishers are willing to take risks, but also willing to, like you said, especially at the beginning of a writer's career, are willing to sort of work with them on the manuscript because they see the potential in it and, you know, kind of whether it's through editorial or, you know, whatever that is, but work with them because they believe in a writer's work. Did you find this to be the case with Coffeehouse?
You know, with my manuscripts, they were fairly done. Probably the first one we did more structural editing. And they also do a really good job with, I mean, the line-by-line editing. They do look at every single, our editor and then our copy editor, very, very thorough. But they really don't make, I haven't had the experience of making a lot of changes, but any changes that they've considered, I mean, almost always I agree, and then I think it makes the book stronger.
Right.
So that's, you know, as a writer, it's a great pleasure to have someone read your work closely, understand it, and even be able to make suggestions to make the work even more itself, I guess.
That's right. And another way I guess we could put that is that, you know, that the publisher gets our vision, you know, as an author, they get the vision behind it, and then they're willing to put their, you know, resources and support into that. And that's something that's just, to me, is, you know, critical, especially when you're working on a manuscript that isn't, you know, I guess sort of quote unquote straightforward, or and it falls into a traditional, you know, sort of label. But really, when you kind of push the envelope a little bit in the way that your book, all of your books, but specifically Unbearable Splendor pushes it, you know.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I'm not sure if Alan did this. He probably did, but I know Chris does this, that he'll work with young or newer writers, even if the intent is not to publish them, or even if they're not interested in being published by Coffee House. But if he feels like this is an important voice to guide in some way, or if he feels like that's something that Coffee House can do, it's not just a sense of like, well, can we make money from this writer? Yes, no. It's really about what is, you know, how can Coffee House be a positive force in literary conversations and development of American literature and world literature. So it's a very inspiring model to me.
Great. Yeah. So I think it's a perfect fit for this book. Now, as for the book Unbearable Splendor, you know, I was trying to tell a friend about this, the book, and as I was trying to explain it, I said something to the effect of, and tell me if this is wrong or right, and also I'd like to hear your own definition of the book, but I said something to the effect of, it's a collection of work that is not only poetry, but it's essay also. It kind of defines, I think it defines label, and it's about the immigrant experience, but written from a Korean-American perspective, and I feel like it goes beyond merely conveying the experience. It actually challenges us and forces us to reconsider what that means to be an immigrant / woman of color in this country. Is that about right? Or
I think that's a really great way of putting it. Yeah,
maybe
totally.
Maybe there's a lot of words, too many words in that, but you know.
No, totally. And I think, you know, for me, I was really trying to think through this idea. I started because I was going to rewrite The Odyssey.
Wow. Right.
From a, you know, kind of like through a feminist lens, or I've been really, for several years now, thinking not very well and not very necessarily effectively, but just about the epic and the masculine epic and Western and Greek epics, usually involving kind of war, and just thinking about our time of many wars, and also the notion of hospitality, because as a Korean orphan and adoptee, I'm part of this whole small displaced or 200,000 displaced Korean citizens who our country decided there was no future for us as Korean citizens, and that we were this impure, you know, children of unwed mothers or children of American GIs and Korean women or so on and forth. We need to be purged from the body politic.
And so,
you know, how is the notion of hospitality, the politics of hospitality, on the familial, intimate level, from nation to nation, how do nations use hospitality, or the idea of, you know, how does that interact with white saviorism, colonialism, Western imperialism, military, client states, and just our current crises of migration, refugees, displacement, following the money, like all of those things. Right. Because the Odyssey, back to the Odyssey, is really, as I was rereading it, I realized how much it was about hospitality and how much Odysseus has to depend on the hospitality of strangers.
Right.
And he's constantly being addressed as dear stranger. And then even when he goes home, in disguise and so on and so forth. And then Penelope and her unwilling hospitality for these suitors who are trying to win her hand to get Odysseus's riches and all of that. And just thinking about the United States and its propaganda self-concept as like the world's hospitality center.
Right, absolutely.
So those were a lot of things that I was trying to push through this book or explore in hopefully some ways that Korean, that hasn't shown up in like Asian American poetry as much, or actually, I mean, a lot of Asian American poets I think are working with these kind of transnational
Right, right.
Idea.
Well, you know what? Actually, would you mind starting us off with reading an excerpt from the book so we can, so our listeners can get a sense of what's inside of it?
Sure.
Cool.
I'm going to read this poem about Antigone,
nice.
Which might seem like it doesn't make sense with all of these ideas. And it's called The Error of Blood Relation, based on Antigone's Nature by William Robert. Where is this criminal? Brother, cadaver, across her mortal limits in the terrain of the impossible, we can follow her strange latitudes. Why doesn't she fly? Antigone, sister, daughter, the uncradled, the unbride, bear her name, tame her, dazzling this line of sight. Were we born to love? Flight through the palace, an arrow through Ismene, oil on the body, dust on the body, birds and dogs unmasking a cadaver named Brother. What is a king for? Traitor, the body, the loudness of duty, Polynices, did you think the throne would fit down your throat alone? Brave river of men behind you, a wonderland of death. Is it better to know? Woman, child, relieve us of our weather full of battle luster. A child of incest, resist traditional lines of genealogy. The sky was a bright choir of gold, a carnival of brothers. We love war. Soldiers losing their names. Gods, leave us to make my name Frey, my brother, fury, form, and torn. Can't you be quiet and just live? Antigone, speaking and acting from the other side, beyond altars and thrones, into the crypt of heart and home, a woman who improperly speaks, who makes marriage with the systematically fatal. Take me with you. Wakes the brother from the cadaver, disappearing boat, what blood and threat heaves us across the threshold, household, we walk every barren for fidelity to the dead, feeding fine on our common loss. Any cost, don't leave me here alone. Incest in the last dress, hanging in your virgin's closet, hoarding conjugal surplus and in debt to its final price. Where have we courted this sex dialectic? I don't know if I'm a woman here at last. Subjects, severing, suffering, are we ruined citizens, any contested king of balm and sin, the error of blood relation, the mother of my own death. Antigone, a new mother, asunder, some heavy ledger to taint and tear you, make you cave and kin, my sister of unbearable splendor. Until death do us unite. Daughter of cadavers, your wedding underground, a dire foreign bargain, make yourself a stranger. Now with your betrothed. Father, mother, brothers, I brought you my eyes. Now with your brother, all together, dining on the dark.
And you are listening to the voice of Sun Young Shin, reading from her new collection of poetry / essays, Unbearable Splendor, out with Coffee House Press. You know, one of the things that, first of all, excellent poem. This is one of the ones actually I have marked up here so that way I could ask you about. But, you know, one of the things is that you have several sections here that, you know, where you use these epigraphs or maybe not epigraphs, but you reference others' use of Antigone. You know, you talk obviously in this one that you just read was William Roberts' Antigone's Nature. And then later on, you talk about Valerie Reed's bringing Antigone home. And I'm wondering, you know, if you could sum up maybe what Antigone represents for you in reference to this body of work here, this book specifically. What does Antigone come to mean through your lens?
I think that she really means the stranger who has erupted out of domesticity, or she, you know, she was a princess, the daughter of Oedipus and, you know, her mother, who turns out to be her grandmother. And then when Oedipus, like a good Greek hero, takes action and gets to the bottom of things and finds out who he really is. And then the rest of his genealogy after him is revealed to be tainted. And I think that as a metaphor for the adoptee experience or someone who is a genealogical disruption because we've been taken out of our genealogical line, we've been grafted into another genealogy, we've been renamed, citizenized, renaturalized, right. You know, all of that. But all of that is so obscured and hidden, and we step into this kind of a fiction. But right. It's always falling. It's always, there's so much pressure within, in the body of the, you know, the adoptee or the daughter of incest or right. Whatever kind of familial kind of monster in a way. Yeah, so that's like, and I just found her, the focus on the play as I was rereading it and reteaching it, the focus on bodies being in the wrong places, to me also seemed so relevant for all of our warfare.
Ah, yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the other things, just to kind of shift gears a little bit here, is the book is also made up of, you utilize, you know, external material like documents, graphs. And I think of the section that's titled Harness, you know, on the last page, you have this piece called No Record. And as someone who has worked with, you know, official documents and records myself, I appreciate the way that you use this material, not only like as a visual device, but, you know, it's really an opportunity to deconstruct quote unquote official language means and how it works on us. You know, and I really love this last part where you write, we are a copy and an original. We will make a record. Can you tell us just a little bit more about, you know, why you choose to use these official records and or how, you know, how you've come to using these official records in your work?
Right. I think, you know, I mean, I've always kind of had felt like my Korean papers and my adoption papers were almost like a fetish, like they were magical, you know, spells, because they made a new person. They like erased a person.
Yeah. Yeah.
They made a whole new family of one person.
Right. Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
But people obviously don't come from nowhere, but that's right. The fiction of the adoptee that has to be made available for consumption into a new family, the way it's worked.
Right.
And it's changing, thankfully, because of advocacy and just all kinds of, you know, lesser stigma against single mothers and all of that.
Sure.
And I think, you know, just the fact that, like, papers, as you know, paperwork can be a life or death matter, right?
Yeah, right.
And people
Absolutely.
Who aren't, whose lives have not been subjected to invented paperwork or, you know, basically being laundered legally. And for America, that's so many of us, right?
Right.
But native born, you know, like white, Christian, straight, cisgender human beings who are in the normative system that has stamped them from birth as like fully human, you know, citizen, voter, male, whatever, the norm. And those are the people who have held all the power and have held the rest of our lives and continue to hold vulnerable people's lives in the palms of their hand, right? If you're in any under any kind of fascist, martial, or just regular everyday state systems, you don't have the right papers, right? You can die. You can be killed. You can be jailed. Your body can be violated.
Absolutely.
And we're seeing that every day.
Yeah.
And so I was trying to use my particular experience, which isn't one of, like, it's of certain kinds of violence, but it's one, you know, people use the adoptee as a symbol of, like, the success of multiculturalism, the success of Christian charity, the success of the first world over the third world, the success of white over Asian, over African, over Colombian, whatever, because it's so valorized and, you know, long since felt like, well, we need to look at the particulars in those primary documents or copies of primary documents are one way that hopefully people who don't have the experience of documents holding their fates to see how they're constructed, of course, and they're constructed usually to maintain power or to serve those who want children or who don't want certain kinds of people in their country or who want certain kinds of laborers or, you know, it's all just about power. And those documents are presented as, you know, like religious, biblical documents, like real, true, good, honest, sacred,
absolutely. And, you know, specifically in the case of this piece here in your book called No Record, you know, I'm talking about the family registration. And it's interesting, you know, that in a sense, you know, you point to this idea of how the document is actually used to, for erasure. And only so that you are left to reconstruct, you know, the sort of the new self. That's how it came across to me, because there's so many sort of unanswered questions in this document here, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Interesting.
Right.
You know, and then you also, I want to, at the beginning of the book, actually, and this was kind of one of the things that pulled me into the book, was that you talk about, you actually write quite a bit at the beginning, you introduce us to this idea of holes. Can you talk to us a little bit more about the holes?
Yes, I was inspired by the Korean writer Kim Hae-soon, who's a poet who's a much more grotesque and kind of surreal style than me, but she was using black holes in several of her different works, and they came to take on a lot of different meaning. I'm interested in the cosmos period and black holes as just fascinating, kind of difficult to understand, you know, but I also think like loss and loss of identity feels like a black hole because it seems like it's a vacuum that is constantly sucking in meaning and not letting anything out. And you can't, I mean, I think it's also like the past that someone who doesn't have access to their ancestors or their family, there's nowhere to go. And so, I mean, it feels like this psychic black hole. I think that, you know, the whole as bodily, the whole as entrance, the whole as exit, the whole as place of, you know, where the integrity of the body or like traffic transit between inside and outside as as really charged kinds of thresholds. All those things I thought I was thinking about in terms of, you know, womanhood and migrant and like our vulnerabilities and our things that are essentially like can never be really mapped.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that comes to mind this. I was reading an interview where with you that the interview described your work as cerebral, quote unquote, cerebral. And while I can definitely see it as cerebral, for me, the word that actually came to mind was visceral. I thought of your work more as visceral, really. Often you call attention to the body and also to, like you said, womanhood, this idea of movement, migration, adoption, you know, and the language itself is very visceral, you know. Would you consider your writing visceral?
I think so. Yeah. I like that word because I think that, you know, it also really is about how we as people of color in this country are constantly being reduced to our bodies.
Yeah, right.
Or, you know, things are going to happen to us based on how our body looks, not based on anything we've done or anything we think.
Right.
You know, so.
Yeah, maybe that's because it's on my, it's sort of, that's what's been on my radar, you know, lately too, as well, just the body and what that means, you know, as a person of color in this country today. And so that's, as I was reading your book, that's kind of what kept resonating with me was that visceral aspect, or at least, you know, the sort of, you know, this physical aspect, the physical, the language that you apply and that you use in these essays and poems to me, it just, you know, resonated with that kind of physicality. And I thought, gosh, this really is an important book, you know, but equally, I think there's a fine balance actually between that and the cerebral as well, obviously, but that was the part that resonated with me most. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Would you mind reading another excerpt for us?
Sure.
Cool.
Do you have any requests or?
Well, yeah, I do. I really like the, let's see, on page 35, Exactly Like You.
Okay.
And, you know, feel free to read. I know that these, some of these kind of, you know, sort of, they have no ending, no, they're meditations in some way. So feel free to read as much of that as you like or as little as you like as well.
Yeah, I can read up until the, like, the asterisk. And if it's too long, you have to spell. Okay. Exactly like you. The words he uttered were no longer understandable, apparently, although they seemed clear enough to him. From The Metamorphosis, Franz Kafka. You've had yourself stolen, haven't you? There is someone who looks exactly like you, isn't there? From The Disowned Student by Kim So-un. It is now known that a fetus dreams. Infants make memories, memories not accessible to the older mind, but perhaps to other systems of the body, older systems than our frontal lobe and other parts of our brain that developed later in our evolution. Dreams occur during REM sleep, which, according to Dr. Charles P. Pollack, director of the Center for Sleep Medicine at New York Presbyterian Weill Cornell Hospital, is an evolutionarily old type of sleep that occurs at all life stages, including infancy and even before infancy in fetal life. We cannot find our original family is unknown to us. No access to stories about our fetal life or to the body of the mother who was the creator, protector, and nurturer of that, our life. We were with her until we were about blank. We were breastfed and bonded. Did you know that fetuses have a developed sense of smell? And as soon as 3 days after birth, newborns are able to recognize their own mother's amniotic fluid. The indelibility of the scent of maternal milk follows soon after. At 2 weeks old, a baby can distinguish her mother's breast milk from that of another. Though we humans often give less attention to our sense of smell than we do to other senses, sight, sound, touch, for babies, and perhaps all of us at all stages of our lives, it is primary. For at least the first 2 months of life, a baby prefers the unmistakable scent of her own mother to any other odor. We were born in or around May of 19 blank. unknown are our birth date or our name, slipperiness of a shared time. One is an object easily laundered and transferred, relocated and reassigned, physically safe, perhaps, and fed and sheltered, perhaps, but without one's first materials and self and home, one's mother, one's Ur body. A few months after our birth, on August 15, 1974, Park Chung-hee, the military dictator of South Korea who had declared himself president for life, was the target of an assassination attempt by Moon Sigwang. This violent incident resulted in the death by gunfire of Park's wife, Yuk Young-soo, and a high school student who was part of a choir performing at the ceremony. Our country, a people with a continuous history of over 5,000 years, was left divided since the end of the Korean War, that peninsula-wide trauma that resulted in tens of thousands of children being made available for adoption to the West, first to the U.S. The profound disruption of the end of Japan's colonial occupation, the brutal civil war, and the aftermath orchestrated by the U.S. resulted in unprecedented political and social change. Perhaps our father and mother were people from the North, refugees to the South, ultimately trapped below the 38th parallel. Perhaps they were married, but we were the fourth child, one too many. Perhaps our mother was raped by a taxi driver. Perhaps our parents were involved in an extramarital affair and could not be together. Perhaps our father died or moved away. Park's daughter, Park Geun-hye, now 60 years old, who was a young woman of 22 when we were born, was very recently elected president of the Republic of Korea, the first woman to hold this office. She, being the daughter of a dictator, among other things, is a figure of controversy. Underneath or merely behind the machinery of politics, we wonder what dreams her mother, Young-soo, had while she was pregnant with Geun-hye. What maternal stamps and stains marked her, competed or melded with Chung-hee's heritable contributions? Could they have predicted that the mother, the first lady of a despot, would give way in this manner to the daughter?
And that was the voice of the poet Sun Young-shin, reading from her latest collection of poetry, Unbearable Splendor, out with Coffee House Press. It's a remarkable book and a very vital and necessary one in today's time. So you want to be sure to pick that up. Sun Young-shin, thank you so much for joining us today on Words on a Wire.
You are so welcome. Thank you, Tim.
Absolutely.
I'm so honored.
Absolutely. Likewise. And, you know, we continue to, you know, look forward to your next work and follow up with that.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Take care.
You too. Bye.
We'd like to thank our guest today, the one and only brilliant poet Sun Young-shin, whose latest book is titled Unbearable Splendor. It's out with Coffee House Press. You want to be sure to pick that up. You won't be disappointed. That wraps it up for this edition of Words on a Wire. I'm Tim Hernandez, and we'll see you next week, same time, same place on KTEP 88.5 FM.